Welcome back to the Famous Monsters Podcast, your home to everything related to horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and all things that make you say, oh, damn, we gotta run. I'm George, your jack of all trades. With me is our editor-in-chief, Holly.
Hello.
Jason the Falcon.
Hey, guys.
And, of course, we have Chase.
Heyo.
Now, before we get into this, let's hear a message from our sponsor. Are you tired of wearing the same old tee that mommy got you? Then head on over to Captain Company, the official store of all things Famous Monsters. Adorn your body with the ghoulies that made it cool to be a monster. Whether it's Frankenstein's creature or a creature that stalks the Black Lagoons, we've got what you need to feed the fashion beast within. So hop onto your computer or phone and check out CaptainCompany.com. That's CaptainCompany.com. CO.com. Now back to the show. Thanks, Tom. You get on top of things.
That was excellent. Who was that? He should come back for more.
That means our intern, Tommy.
Thanks, Tommy.
Yeah. Last guy didn't work out. We had to sacrifice him to something or whatever. But it is the end of 2019. And as we head into the new year, all of us over here at FM can't help but look back at all of the amazing films that came out in the past 10 years. And with much debate and tribunal sacrificing, we managed to put together our top 10. And while we tried to keep it as horror-centric as possible, some movies made their way in and just couldn't be ignored. So with no further ado, let's just get into this. And at number 10, we have What We Do in the Shadows, a nice 2014 flick directed and starring Taika Waititi and Jemaine Clement. Holly, editor-in-chief, it's been a long time since you've been with us. What stuck out about this movie for you?
Oh, well, as a fan of vampire movies in general, like pretty much everything this movie was making fun of, I just was so sublimely entertained. I mean, everyone knows who Taika Waititi is now because of Thor Ragnarok. And everyone knows that he's just, you know, he's brilliant and off the wall and goofy and crazy comedy stuff. Although when What We Do in the Shadows came out, not many people knew who he was. It's just, the whole film is perfection. It's like a fake vampire documentary. And, you know, you've got the faux sexy one. You've got the Nosferatu one that lives in the basement, you know, and basically they're vampire roommates. And it's just,
I think
so
it's
many
great
things
that the
once.
Nosferatu,
like,
one's name is Peter with a Y.
It's so funny.
How about you, Jason? What was something that was so great about this movie for you?
This is actually the only one on the list that I haven't seen yet, and I don't have a good reason why I haven't seen it, because I really have wanted to see it for a while. I don't unfortunately have much to say in that regard. But everything about it seems like it would be something totally up my alley. Because, I mean, fake documentaries and vampires and Taika Waititi, everything Holly said basically is stuff that I'm into. I just have not actually seen it yet. I have failed you.
You'll be forgiven.
Thank you.
Now, Chase, you've
but
seen
go
this
and
movie,
watch
is that
it
correct?
Because it's awesome.
I have. I've only seen it once, but it was a good one. I liked it.
Yeah, I gotta say, something that didn't get brought up
a lot of good movies
by you,
here.
Holly,
wow.
Is the fact,
ooh,
that there's also a werewolf gang in this. I loved the werewolf gang. The leader of it is led by Rhys Darby, and this guy's hilarious. Like, he's a New Zealander himself, and his voice has probably been notified in things like Voltron as the right hand of the princess.
Oh,
and he's a very zany guy. He was also like in Yes Man as the guy who was the boss of, like, Jim Carrey's character. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in this that I love so much. And it's when the gangs kind of meet up with each other. And one of the werewolf members says a derogatory term to one of the vampires. And he stops him right there. He's like, now, what do I tell you about that? It's like, what are we? It's like, we're werewolves, not swearwolves. Mm-hmm. It's such a cheesy thing, but it kind of sums up the whole movie, like exactly like how corny it is. But it's the best kind of corny. Like, it's right up the FM alley. I'm going to watch that, I think, this weekend now after talking about it. I forget how happy it made me after the first time I've seen it.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of comedies in general, but What We Do in the Shadows is top tier good stuff.
But there you go. That's some high praise for this film.
I'm sorry. I got to be honest.
Someone who doesn't like comedies likes this movie. That shows how good it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we are leading into a movie that Holly is a big fan of. And at number 9, we have Snowpiercer, which is also another 2014 film directed by a phenomenal director, Bong Joon-ho, which starred Chris Evans, Tilda Swinton, Kang Ho-sung, Ed Harris, Octavia Spencer, and even the late, great John Hurt. Like, this is quite a cast.
Yeah,
for me, this was kind of like, this was like our modern day kind of like Soylent Green kind of
film.
It's
an incredible cast.
Honestly. Uh-huh.
Snowpiercer is definitely, in fact, if I had to pick a top movie of the decade, it would be Snowpiercer. I was blown away by it. I was fortunate enough to see it in a very small screening room in Beverly Hills with only about 30 other people. And all I knew about it was that it was directed by Bong Joon-ho,
such
who
a
had
good
directed
one
The
too.
Host, which
yeah.
is a crazy Korean monster movie from 2006. Also really worth watching. I knew that he had directed it and that Chris Evans was in it, and it was a post-apocalyptic movie, and that's all I knew. And so I went in totally blind, and I came out just, I could not believe what I had seen. Like, I knew as soon as I came out too that it was like Bong Joon-ho, like this guy is going to be on everybody's lips in a couple of years. Like he's just incredible. And you know, of course, now he's getting all sorts of awards for Parasite, and that's really, really happy to see for me. But yeah, but Snowpiercer just it to me, it brings together every element of an awesome film, from great effects, great cast, you know, just a really cool, interesting premise, and just some general messed up stuff, like stuff where they walk through train cars and you're like, what is going on? And if a movie can make me go WTF more than once, I'm impressed. That makes it a good movie. So Snowpiercer is absolutely mind-blowing.
It really is
not say enough great
one of those
movies
that is kind of beyond reproach. Like, I can't think of a single thing I would possibly change about Snowpiercer. It's like, to use a word, it kind of feels like you're getting hit by a train when you're watching it. That's how much of an impact when you're right, exactly. Like, how do you talk about this movie without using like a million train metaphors? But it's one of the movies that have such a distinct storytelling style with how linear it is, that it like there's so many like levels to it.
Yeah,
how incredibly linear it is from like the direction the people are facing in it. And Chris Evans did such a good job. Like, I mean, everyone knows he's a great actor, but it had been kind of a while since we were used to seeing him as not like a good guy at this point, that it was really refreshing to see him be, I mean, not that he was a bad guy, but he wasn't Steve Rogers.
He's a rebel.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, agreed. George, Chase, opinions on Snowpiercer?
Lead with you.
Me? Okay. I haven't seen it yet, so this is all.
Oh.
I'm just sitting here taking all this in, like, ooh, things, stuff, trains. All right.
Trains.
Train puns.
I used to collect trains as a kid.
I like where this is going.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm gonna have to watch it, but I'm still not quite sure exactly what it's about. All I know is there's a train and there's snow.
Well, I can get into that one then. So
go
the
ahead,
premise
George.
Is that, like I said, it's post-apocalyptic. So the world had done this thing where they tried to do something with the climate and it went wrong. And now all the life that's left is on this train circling this ice age like world, and it has to keep on moving because if it doesn't, it'll freeze and everyone will die. As far as everyone is concerned on the train, there is no life left on the planet. Everything is dead. And on the train, like in the world, there is a hierarchy, there is a class level. So if you're in the back of the train, you're the lower class. It's all the poor, all the dirty, and like mm-hmm. they pretty much work and keep the train running. And of course, as you go to each level forward, you have a higher class. You have the class, you have actual schools, and then you have the upper crust of everything. Certain people do get chosen and brought forward. Of course, they don't know what they're being brought forward for.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I'm not going to say the ending of this because you haven't seen it yet.
Say, right. Hey, you won. Come on up to the front. They just throw them out of the train.
Woo-hoo. They get a snow vacation. But Chris Evans obviously is a part of this little group of people who believe something is up, something is wrong, and they're trying to stop the man pretty much. And he eventually goes to this adventure where he goes to the front of the train and figures out what is happening.
I like your comparison to Sawyer. I think that's a really, really solid comparison, especially with the
I may have given it
the
away.
Stuff they're eating.
Well, it is a little bit different. Now I'm glad that I didn't make a comment on it, because I don't think like that scene when you find out the stuff about what we're talking about is so impactful that it gnarly.
Yeah.
It's kind of the only word I can use for it. It was gnarly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think something for me that stuck out of like just how it was filmed and everything is like the people who are in charge, it's a very narrow-minded way of thinking of how they are. And when you think of a train, it is narrow. It is tight. It's claustrophobic. And that's how I felt while watching it. I felt like I was in this tight situation where there were no choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yep. And it's like, and you're going through that adventure with him. And I always think it's amazing when a filmmaker can make you feel what the character is probably feeling as they go through their journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And can we talk about that scene in the tunnel with the fish and the axes? I mean,
oh my God.
Holy crap.
Such a good, that was one of the better fight scenes that I have seen in
just incredible.
Ever.
They're fit.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I mean, not fish with axes, but there are fish involved. And axes. Yeah.
That sounds like a hell of a fight scene.
Yeah.
So there's mutant fish with axes. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's what climate change does to people. It makes your fish fight with axes.
Yeah, no, it's just, I can't say enough about Snowpiercer. I just want to marry it. God. I came out of the screening just like that. That movie was chef's kiss. So good.
Well, I guess you got your homework for you, Chase. You got to watch Snowpiercer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess so.
As we go through this, we'll all take notes like, all right, I got to watch that thing again. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Now, within this top 10 that we put together, there were definitely movies that each of us probably wished were on this list that didn't make it. So we're going to have our moments where we get to put a little spotlight on those things and maybe a film that didn't impress us as much as it should have. Jason, do you want to kick us off with your personal pick and personal not so much liked movie?
Yeah. Do you want to start with the good or the bad?
Let's go with the good.
Okay. So the last half of this decade in terms of horror movies for me was kind of defined by A24. I mean, starting with The Witch and then going to Hereditary and Midsommar and then ending with The Lighthouse. I think I have to go with like my top that wasn't already on this list was The Lighthouse. Because there's not really any other movie that I've ever seen that's like it. I mean, obviously we all know from The Witch, director Robert Eggers is amazing at really creating a very bleak atmosphere. And it kind of feels like he cranked it up past 11 with this one, because it's entirely shot in black and white. There's two characters in it that are completely alone, and it was shot in such a tight aspect ratio that was practically square. It wasn't 100% square. It was like 1:1.19 or something like that. But he did such a good job of using that aspect ratio to like kind of direct the eye in shots and make you feel just sort of like closed in by nothing. Like, you're surrounded by nothingness, to really put you right there with the characters. And it's almost hard to call it like an actual horror movie, because it was really half comedy. Like, it was a very funny movie. And it touched on a lot of different parts of like folklore and mythology. Like, if you see the end, there's like a really clear like Greek myth that they're referencing. But then as you kind of go through it, you find more pieces, and then like old references to like sailors superstitions and stuff like that. And it, I mean, Willem Dafoe's accent in it is hilarious. I want to watch it again with subtitles because I can barely understand him. But it was, it was really like, you never knew what was going to happen next. If it was going to be like a fight or something horrifying or something hilarious or something really genuinely tender. It was exceptionally crafted. I've never seen anything like it.
I'm going to see it.
Yeah, that's on my to watch list. I have not seen it.
Yeah, yet, for sure. I think everyone should see it, even if it's just for the experience. Like, it took me about 24 hours to determine if I liked it or not after I saw it. But then as soon as everything had sunk in, I was like, oh, wait, no, this is amazing. This is probably one of my favorite movies of all time.
Ooh.
Wow. Damn.
I feel that's a little high praise. Biased because it is kind of gay.
But woo-hoo, the gayer the better, I say.
Here.
No, but it's a definitely more than just subtext. So yeah, I have to go with The Lighthouse for my top. But shout out in general to all A24 horror movies from this decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That's a good point. That they have been knocking it out the park with every film.
Yeah, they really have.
So and then, what is the bad one?
The bad one is it has to be It Chapter 2. Because it's like, yeah,
oh no,
there were bad horror movies that came out. Like, The Bye Bye Man obviously was not a good horror movie, but also, like, did anyone have any expectations for The Bye Bye Man to be anything good? I think that's one of the things that really was so disappointing about It Chapter 2 is, like, you kind of knew going into it, there's no way it can live up to the first one, because the first one was so good, but it was entirely focused on the kids. And I think we all knew the adult part would be a little bit more of a struggle, but to fall that far short of the first one was devastating. I was so upset after I got out of that movie. And I remain just as upset, if not more so. I hated it.
Yeah, I remember talking about it. Yeah. I enjoyed it, but I can definitely see your problems with it. It definitely was not as good as the first one. The first one was so great. And while there were elements of Chapter 2 that I really enjoyed, like Bill Hader's performance, for example. There were also elements that were kind of unnecessary and weird.
I think the only good part about it for me was the actors, and that is a terrible thing to have be the only good part. Like, because obviously Bill Hader is amazing in kind of everything he does, but like, for me, it's like, I couldn't even get past the opening scene, not just because of how like terrible that is to watch, but when you compare the opening scenes of Chapter 1 and Chapter 2, the opening scene to It Chapter 1 was amazing and set the bar for the rest of the movie. Like, that was the tone setter. And it was such like a shock. Like, I remember like looking around in the theater. I remember looking, like, talking about it when we did our podcast episode on it. And it was like, oh, this is what we're in for. Like, this is crazy. But then this one, it was like, if it was meant to be like, look at how brutal Pennywise was, Pennywise was kind of just like the vulture going in to scavenge the kill that wasn't even really his. And like, I guess the kind of point was the whole town is sort of under his influence, but they didn't really do a good job showing it, and it just felt kind of weak on his end.
Okay, well, I mean, to me, could I just throw my hat in the ring here for that opening scene, which is really hard to watch? I definitely think they were drawing a parallel between that and the gay subplot in the film. What Richie was terrified would have happened to him if he had stayed in Derry. That's what I got from it, anyway.
Yeah, but it just felt like such a poor way to do that, because I mean, they did throw plenty of that into the rest of the film, where it's like, I feel like the beginning scene was just superfluous. Like, if I could change it, like, I would take this scene where he attacked the little girl under the bleachers and put that, have that be the opening scene, and just forget the whole like gay bashing beginning, even though it was in the book. It's like, they clearly were fine with changing some things from the book, so I don't understand why they chose to leave that part in there.
Valid.
Yeah. I think the biggest problem with me, like, I liked the movie, but for a storytelling perspective, there was a lot of retelling of everything from the first one. It's like, if you were watching this together as a marathon, you're like, all right, I just watched chapter one, now I'm watching chapter two, and chapter two is recapping everything in chapter one as if I didn't watch it.
Right.
Well, that was what I was nervous about when I first heard that they were going to separate it between the kids and the adults, because part of what makes the book work for me is the simultaneousness of it, is that sometimes you can't tell if it's happening in the present or in the past. And I think putting such a definitive line down the middle of the two time periods is a mistake. And it definitely showed in chapter two, that just wasn't anywhere near as good.
Yeah, I think it gave them a lot of structural issues, because that whole middle part where they're like, okay, we're going to split up and reminisce for an hour and a half. It was almost 3 hours long, and it's like, oh, I felt every minute of it. But yeah, that's my best and worst.
Well, with that, let's hop back into the things that made us very happy. And at number 8, we have Shin Godzilla, which was in 2016, directed by Hideki Anno and Shinji Higuchi. We were lucky enough to actually have Higuchi at one of our shows, and we got to show this movie at one of our events, and it had to have been one of the longest lines that I think I'd ever seen for something.
Oh, before. Yeah. With good reason, too, because Shin Godzilla is another one where it's like, I can't think of a single bad thing to say about it, to be honest.
I mean, I feel like some people maybe had a problem with, you know, its slowness, so to speak, in the beginning, just because it took so long to, like, get things going. But to me, the first, like, half hour, an hour was total government satire. Like, I was just laughing my ass off the entire time. Mm-hmm. Like, every time they had to find a new committee to deal with a new development in the disaster, like, oh, that's for this part of the government. They have to go to a totally other floor. It's like, it's so funny.
This was hilarious.
It was amazing, yeah. And then, of course, the design of Shin Godzilla himself is one for the books. Oh. I mean, you think you can't redesign Godzilla in a way that makes him scary again, but this, wow.
Yeah, he looks He looks very eldritch in this movie.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, I also feel like with that adding, like, to his power set, like, I've never seen a Godzilla be that devastating.
Oh, yeah.
With his atomic breath.
Yeah,
I love also that there are stages to him, that he, you know, he crawls on land and he's like a little baby Godzilla, and then he, you know, he grows and stands up. And then, of course, as you were saying, George, the devastation of the atomic breath, the fact that his tail has a face on it, and the atomic breath comes out of the face as well. Like, that just, it's just so badass. I can't even. Wow.
Yeah, I gotta say, I never felt so excited for there to be a sequel to something before with that movie. Like, when it ended and you saw that tail, I was like, what the hell is that coming out of there? I need to have more. What is this?
Yeah, right?
That last, I don't think I've ever seen, I don't think I've ever experienced a movie shake me to my core with the last 5 seconds the way that this, like, oh my God. what a truly deeply unsettling thing to see. I don't want to give away what it is because, Chase, you still haven't seen it yet, have you?
I have not.
Oh, no.
I'm Chase. Such a loser.
No, that's not what I said. It just makes me sad that you're missing out.
You didn't have to say it.
No.
We felt it.
But I definitely want to see it. I just haven't.
Yeah. I have the Blu-ray.
It's great.
Mm-hmm. You better or I'll cry.
Oh. I'll bring it tomorrow.
Yes.
I think a cool thing about this one also is like it kind of harkened back to the original 1954 Godzilla, where it's like you felt like they were having a commentary of this current social climate that they were going through. You know, it's like, I mean, we've talked about this in the office a bit with me and Jason. It's like the first one was obviously talking about the atomic bomb that had hit at Iwo Jima.
Hiroshima, Nagasaki, yeah.
I don't remember places that well, man. I remember movies. But
sorry. But, just trying to get our history straight there.
That's why we have a group. We can fact check each other. You know, and then this one obviously dealing with the nuclear meltdowns that they had. Like, I thought that was a nice thing to kind of relate to and bring it back to the original. Because like, as much as I think we all love every Godzilla film, some of them go astray and you kind of forget what was the whole point of Godzilla and where it came from.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Like, even looking at the most recent one, King of the Monsters, it's like, that doesn't, like, there's a little bit of, like, kind of nuclear stuff going on, but it's not, like a nuclear disaster the way that the original was meant to be.
Hey, King of the Monsters is great, though. Come on. Let's give it some credit.
King of Monsters at all. I love King of Monsters. It's so much silly fun, but, like, the craftsmanship that went into Shin Godzilla, like, relating it back to, like, all the bureaucracy and like even the shots of the younger, like one of the early evolutions, like the tail going over the houses was so reminiscent of footage from the tsunami that it just really made you feel it really hard. Cause it's like, that was not that long before this came out. It was so like, it just kind of captured that whole feeling, but with Godzilla.
The Japanese are very good at that. Capturing the whole terror, nuclear disaster, natural disaster thing.
Yeah. And then all the red tape goes with it.
And they've kind of been screwed over enough times that I guess they've become really good at it, but yeah.
But no, Shin Godzilla is definitely like, that's another one that's like one of the best films I have ever seen from a craft perspective and an enjoyment perspective because I love it. I love his little googly eyes.
Spindly teeth.
Mm-hmm. Well, oh yeah, the teeth are so horrifying. I love that.
Going from such a big film that was Shin Godzilla, we kind of head over to a smaller film that probably didn't get as much attention and praise that it should be getting, which was Cabin in the Woods. Came out in 2012, directed by Drew Goddard, starring Kristen Conley, Chris Hemsworth, Jesse Williams, and my personal favorite of hilarious duo of Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford as the two scientists behind the window.
And it's funny you say that because I feel like it did get a lot of praise when it first came out. Like people were just gushing.
I mean, think there was
deservedly so
praise from the people that got it and understood it, but so many people saw it and didn't quite get that it was supposed to be campy that there was a lot of sort of like weird backlash about it. Like I remember talking to a lot of people that were not people that were very into horror and they were just like, I thought it was really stupid. And it's like, well, I can see why.
Wow, I must live in a bubble. I don't remember that at all. Like,
come on now. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember there being a lot of people feeling like there was like a bait and switch because the trailers for this movie definitely gave you the sense of like, oh, it's the typical going to a cabin in the woods. It's going to be some killing and something that's a monster or whatever. And like these stupid teenagers that just want to have sex and get drunk are all going to get murdered. And that was it.
Right.
And then to have all of a sudden the veil be pulled back, and it's like, oh, no, wait. This was all planned. Mm-hmm. There was a purpose behind all of this. Like for me, I kind of think of it as like an amalgamation of the Evil Dead franchise married with the movie Waxwork. And like, I don't know if anyone's ever seen Waxwork, but like in that movie, there you have these bunch of stupid teenagers that go to this wax museum. And little do they know, each installation at the wax museum is actually real if you cross over its barriers And then you can live out this world of like a werewolf or this guy who does like S&M or whatever. And it'll actually, if you die in that scene.
Nice segue.
Right?
Werewolf or S&M?
Yeah, that's two that stick out in my head. But yeah, if you die in this world, then your soul is taken and you pretty much like feed the machine.
To me, with Cabin in the Woods, what really stands out about it, what makes it different from any other film, is the behind the scenes office stuff with Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins.
Yeah.
Because like the whole like office pool where they're betting which monster is gonna, you know, come in, and the thing with the merman, and just these bored office workers who are essentially like just they're in the corporate drudgery of like sacrificing virgin.
Yeah, even just
it's so ridiculous. It's so good.
Even just the elevator scene was so over the top and fantastic. Oh, that was my favorite moment of the whole movie, I think.
I just remember watching the first 10 minutes and people being like, what the hell? I thought this was a horror movie. Because the first 10 minutes are like just, you know, the two of them like in an office, like walking down the hall and bitching about their office jobs. Yeah. And then of course the unicorn, because the world needs a horror movie where a unicorn is the monster.
I agree.
How about you, Chase? What was your standout moment for this film?
I love the mermaid. I thought that was great. The whole time he's wanting like a mermaid to get in the mix, and he's all upset about it. And then at the end, he gets that. I like that. That's good. But I can see how people, like, if they were looking at it like, oh, it's a horror film. And then when they go to see it and they're like, oh, I was thinking the whole time it's going to be like this terrifying horror film that's going to try to scare me a lot. It's more kind of like this campy, funny horror film kind of thing. I can see why people, if they're going in for like hardcore horror, like I want to be scared kind of thing. If they went into that and watched that, I could see why they'd be upset about it. But like, I didn't really have any expectations when I went to watch it. I was just like, okay, horror film. And so I was like, oh, I like the funny stuff. And it's not like, it wasn't like cheesy, some humor along with all the good horror themes. So
yeah, I think that's what really made it special for me is like, yeah, it had all like the camp and the comedy and everything. But even aside from that, it was still kind of a genuinely good horror film. Kind of like how Drag Me to Hell, like I remember that movie getting a lot of the same reactions of people being like, what, that was so like silly and stupid, because they only knew Sam Raimi from Spider-Man and had never seen, you know, Army of Darkness or the Evil Dead series or any of that, and it kind of took people by surprise. Even aside from that, like the horror that it deals with is legitimately good. It's not just kind of throwaway stuff, which is what I think made Cabin really special for me.
Yeah, to me the whole attitude of Cabin in the Woods can be summed up by the scene where Chris Hemsworth's character is about to, like, you know, he's on the motorcycle and he's about to jump the gulf and like go and get help, and it's like this big serious thing, and they're like, yeah, go and get help, we're all gonna die, and he like jumps the gulf in the motorcycle and just like smacks into the invisible net, and there's just no payoff whatsoever. It's just like, whoops, okay, that's the kind of movie we're dealing with.
Yeah, I love that.
And this was right after the Avengers came out, so everybody saw Chris Hemsworth as Thor, so to like see a scene like that was just priceless. So good.
I know, I always think that Cabin in the Woods is older than Avengers because he looks so much like younger, not in the Thor makeup.
Well, it is. Yeah. They filmed it before.
Oh, is that why?
Okay. Yeah, they filmed it beforehand. It's just
the baby.
Took forever to get released.
Yeah, it didn't get released till a year later. But yeah, they did actually filmed it before Avengers. But I think it got more publicity after Avengers.
Thor 1, though. He looked older than he did in Cabin.
Yeah, well, this is even before Thor. Like, this is way before Thor also. Like, he did this before he did anything for Marvel.
Really? They filmed it that far in advance?
Yeah, like, I think this goes
well,
that
I feel
back.
Like it was shelved, and then Joss Whedon got so much publicity for the Avengers, he was at the tip of everybody's tongue, and everyone was like, oh, Joss Whedon, and he produced Cabin in the Woods, so they sort of dropped Cabin in the Woods and was like, from Joss Whedon, and so everybody went to see it, even though it may have been just, you know, a straight-to-video movie otherwise, you know?
Which, that's something I think that notes why it's so good. It's like, he wrote and produced it, and anyone who watched like the Buffy series or Firefly, he knows how to take something serious, but at the same time, inject a nice sense of humor inside of it. Because Buffy had a lot of funny moments.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't care what people say about Joss Whedon. He's fucking awesome. He's great. He's a fantastic writer.
Who's talking smack about Joss Whedon?
Oh, you know, the internet.
You know,
Twitter.
Those internet trolls.
The interwebs.
All right, we're at that moment again. One of us has to have a personal pick. Chase, what was your personal favorite movie and not so favorite movie?
My favorite is one that I don't think a lot of people ever really think about. It's Sinister.
Okay. The gasps.
We didn't
have a little James Wan on this list. Come on.
A little what?
James Wan.
That's fine. I'm just going to be quiet, and I'm just going to sit here and listen to somebody who loved it. Uh-huh. That's all I'm going to say.
I loved it. It's my favorite one of the decade. Boom. I threw it out there. It's just, I like the story about it. I like the acting. I like a lot of the parts were filmed with that, like, Super 8 style, mm-hmm. and it was all, like, a snuff film, almost, essentially, for each of those films.
Right.
Like that got me. That got to me. Like normally, like when I watch horror films, it's kind of like either completely overboard gore, where it's like, okay, that's not my style. Like it doesn't do anything for me. It's just like, okay, you're pouring a bunch of fake blood on people. I don't care. But then with this, it's just like it felt like close to real, and it was always kind of like that borderline jump scare kind of thing. Like there's the part with a lawnmower. Like you're just watching a recording out in the rain with a lawnmower going through the rainy yard, and then all of a sudden you hear like a loud sound that goes along with it, but then you see like a face that's like someone's like in a I think they have like a burlap sack on their head or something like that, mm-hmm. and the mower just whoop, right up to the head, and then you see it comes back to Ethan Hawke's character, and he's just like like freaking out about it, which I would too, yeah. had I just watched that. I'd be like, oh my god, what did I just watch? I thought they did a really good job with that, like making that feel like really eerie and like you're in it. I don't know. I liked that a lot.
Yeah. He did, with that movie, he did a really good job with, like, because the videos that he was finding and watching, like, were, I think, the best parts about that movie for me. It had the feeling of when you come across, like, a really unsettling video on the internet, except it wasn't on the internet. Like, he's not, like, the actual
tape. Like, creepypasta.
Right, exactly. It felt like that to me, which is super cool. I mean, that first video of the family in the tree, that image is so unsettling, and I think like James Wan has a really good way of doing those super unsettling shots. Like the visuals is one of his strong suits, and Sinister had a lot of really good unsettling visuals.
All right, what was okay, what was the bad movie?
You know what, I'm gonna save my opinion because well, I'm just gonna save it, so we'll get to it later. That's all I gotta say. We'll get to it later.
So what was Chase's bad movie?
You know, I didn't really see as many movies as I'd like to see. And then there was one that, like, online, like, I saw a lot of people, like, on Twitter, Instagram, stuff like that. A lot of people that are really into horror were really into this film. And it never appealed to me to begin with, but I wanted to watch it to see what it was about. But this film, Terrifier.
I knew it! I was trying to...
Like, it is that the one with the clown? Art the Clown.
Maybe yeah, I never yeah. saw it, but
you don't have to waste your time with it.
Good to know.
I think the vibe that I get is the people that really like it are the horror fans that are really into, like, let's see how much blood we can pour on somebody, and, like, let's see just how, like, randomly gruesome someone can be for no reason kind of thing. Ooh. It's like, because there's a scene, I think like, anybody familiar with Terrifier is familiar with the scene where he's got the girl, like, hanging upside down and he saws her in half from the noddy down to the head.
Okay.
I'm not familiar, but it sounds amazing.
Mean, it's not.
I have heard this. Same thing, Chase. I haven't seen it either. I have never gone out of my way to look up anything about it, but I have heard that Terrifier was not that impressive of a movie at all.
Yeah, it's very low production. It's not like good production in it. The dialogue and the storyline are both not appealing. It's just like the acting isn't great. Nothing about it is great, but it's like if you're into that gory, bloody, like I'm gonna saw somebody in half and I'm gonna gouge somebody's eyes out with like the obviously fake eyeball pop out, to where it's not like, oh man, that's good effects, like that looks like a real eyeball popping out of the person's head. It's like, no, it's like a ping pong ball with like some red yarn. It's like, at least have the effects be like, if that's your main thing is like, let's see how gross and gory we can be, which isn't my style because that doesn't do anything for me. It's not like positive or negative. I'm like, meh, I don't need it. But for the people that do want it, at least have it be good. Like, Yeah, I just I didn't even watch it all the way through. I got a little bit past the sawing in half part, and I think, I don't know, something popped up. I don't know, maybe somebody texted me, and I was like, ah, I'll talk to somebody. And I stopped watching it. Not because I was, like, grossed out or anything. It was just there wasn't anything there for me.
No, you can always tell what a movie is when you're not into movies, when you can just stop watching it and be like, okay, fine. I don't care. It just means you don't care and you're not invested. And that's not a good sign. So
if I'm hearing correctly, I have this movie on my desk at work. Don't even bother opening it.
I mean, it depends. If you're into that kind of stuff, you can.
Well, it's funny because I keep I know they're different, but I keep people confusing Terrifier, which is the one you're talking about, with Terrified, which is a foreign film on Shudder, which I watched, which is actually great. It's really, really great. But it's just the two titles are so similar. Mm-hmm. I keep getting them confused and I have to remind myself that Terrifier is the one with the clown and Terrified is the one with the naked ghost, the creepy naked ghost.
Note to self: watch Terrified.
It's a male ghost, by the way. So I mean, I don't know if that changes your
note to self.
Not at all. Holly, I am an artiste.
Just checking.
The human body is beautiful.
Equal opportunity nudity.
A perfect segue, because as we speak about clowns, at number six is another clown, and it's It Chapter One. The one that we loved. This came out in 2017.
We even
had a nice little meetup with our fans in our little town of Santa Rosa. And we loved the crap out of this movie. Now, granted, two people in our group did not watch it with us because they did not like clowns. And the mere sight of clowns made them furious. But for the rest of us that could handle this, we enjoyed every second of it.
Wait. Who?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, I didn't remember that. Okay.
Yeah. It's like, it's not even fear. It's just like pure rage.
Yep. Burning rage.
Wow.
But the rest of us didn't have that feeling. We had pure joy and excitement as these little twerks got terrified by this clown of Pennywise, the dancing clown.
That's twerp, not twerks. Just saying. Twerk is the dance. Say, twerp is the
I didn't
kid.
Say twerking.
Just saying.
Hey.
All right. That could be the.
And I'm pretty sure
Pennywise probably was twerking at one point.
He probably was.
That's just clarifying.
I mean, he is the dancing clown.
Sure is.
Can we just talk about what made this movie work, which is the kid actors? Like, honestly. They are the reason the movie. I mean, okay, great. Bill Skarsgård was awesome as Pennywise, and he was very creepy, and those scenes were well done. But as far as I'm concerned, what kept me watching were the kids.
Yeah,
I just thought they were fantastic, funny, and gross and ridiculous. And
all of them were amazing. Cool to see all of them go on to do other things, because I feel like even just the last like 2 weeks there's been like I've seen trailers or like the kid that played Bill, I don't remember his actor's name, but he was in Knives Out.
Jaden Martell.
Knives Out. But all of the kids in Chapter One did such a phenomenal job. They really they sold it.
And Finn Wolfhard, of course, who was already famous for Stranger Things at that point, but I also like to shout out the undersung Jack Dylan Grazer playing Eddie, who is freaking amazing and hilarious. Like that kid, wow. I just want to adopt that kid. He's so awesome. he went on to play Freddie Freeman in Shazam. And I just think he's so funny.
The kid played Ben is in the new Are You Afraid of the Dark, and he did a great job in that too.
Ooh.
Yeah, I gotta say it's true. Like these kids, like their chemistry together. Like, there are adults who have studied years to master this craft who don't have the chemistry and the know-how that these kids brought to the table. I'd actually watched the thing of the behind the scenes for it, and Bill Skarsgård was saying, like, how much he was blown away by these kids. Because he's a monster in this thing. And he's getting in these kids' spaces, doing his little thing and everything. And it's terrifying. As adults, I think it's fair to say, like, I'm not afraid of clowns. But if I was a kid and he was in my face, I'd probably be shitting myself.
Yeah.
But like he'd do the scene and then afterwards he'd be like, are you okay? I mean, he's feeling bad. And they're like, oh my God, like you did just an amazing job. It's like, keep it up. Keep it the good work. You're doing great. You're doing great. These are kids, little kids. I'm telling him that he's doing a great job and do more of it. Be scarier. And he's like, oh my God, these kids are like, they're obviously affected in some way. They're tainted that they can just be in front of this monster and not be affected at all.
Tainted.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. But, I gotta say, I'm very excited because we're mentioning how great these kids are and how they're still doing even greater things after this movie. And I'm excited to see Sophia Lillis, I forgot her name in the movie.
Beverly.
Beverly, thank you.
Beverly.
Beverly, she's going to be in the new
Hansel
and Gretel movie coming out. And it looks great.
Oh, yeah. I saw that trailer. Yeah, and it looks pretty cool.
Is in the new Ghostbusters, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like with Finn Wolfhard, you just sort of have to like mention a movie that has an 80s influence, and he just sort of shows up on set. Like, you don't even have to cast him. You know, you're just like, oh, this is an 80s thing. Yeah. Finn Wolfhard's
to the set.
He just comes in, flips his hair past his face, like, I got this.
Well, God bless him because he's fantastic. He's great. Mm-hmm. He really is. And I think Jason, again, I think that's probably why It Chapter 2 was such a letdown for you, because It Chapter 1 was
so
great.
100%. You know? It'd be easy to say like the Bye Bye Man was the worst film of the decade, but there was no hope going into it that it was going to be, you know, good. As like the expectations that Chapter 1 set for Chapter 2 were so high, even though you knew it wasn't going to live up to it. It was just like soul crushing.
Yep.
Even the kid that played Georgie did a great job.
That creepy little kid.
Yeah.
He was creepy.
He was very creepy.
Like, and I gotta say, to give Bill Skarsgård more credit too, like, I first saw him in the show Hemlock Grove on Netflix. And while it's not maybe like the go-to show we're gonna think about when it comes to like vampires and werewolves, mm-hmm. on that show, he was a vampire and very much, I think, considered a sex symbol. You know, like he's supposed to be this hot dude. And to go from that role.
So well, he is a hot dude.
So to go from hot guy hot and be like, yeah, I'm going to play a monster. I'm going to play something that's not sexy.
Yeah.
And you're going to be creeped by me every time you see me now. And I do this stupid smile on a late night show. You know, like that's taking a huge chance in someone's career. Yeah. And I'm glad he did it.
You're right. No, I
doesn't he when he does the like the drifting eye.
That's him. There is no special effects there.
Yeah, apparently he can just do that. Crazy. Like he's got some lazy eye thing
going
on.
There's a really amazing set of images of him in full Pennywise makeup, costume, etc., showing Bill Hader how he can do it. So you see and then the next one he looks so horrified and it's just like jumping back. Yeah, It Chapter 1, really good.
Good stuff.
And that leads us to you have something extra to say about it?
No, I was just gonna say let's just do a super cut. This is mostly the first movie and like, you know, maybe an hour of the second movie and just add in a bunch of extra crazy shit and we have an awesome 4-hour movie. Ta-da!
That sounds good.
I mean, we're almost there, right? On to number 5. We're going through this. Number 5 was a great one. It was Us, which was very recent, 2019, written and directed by Jordan Peele, starring Lupita Nyong'o, Winston Duke, Elizabeth Moss, Tim Heidecker, Shadahi Wright Joseph, and Evan Alex. This cast was great. And this was the second coming of greatness from the brilliant mind of Jordan Peele. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure everyone was at that point. It's like, okay, he did a great job with Get Out, but does he have the ability to do it again? And I think he did it and may have even surpassed at some points.
Yeah.
I liked Us more than I liked Get Out.
Tell us why, Chase.
I liked Us better. I thought it was more, I thought it was creepier. I thought it had more of like a horror vibe to it than Get Out did. But I liked them. I thought they were both great movies. I liked the story of both of them and everything. I love the part when they're inside their friend's house and like everyone's all hell's breaking loose. And the wife, I think, tells like Alexa to call the police or something like that.
Best moment in the film.
Like NWA comes on or whatever. That was great.
Fuck, call the police. Alexa. Now playing Fuck the Police. I died. So good.
Yeah, I mean, that was like kind of going off of what we were saying about Cabin in the Woods, like the blend of horror and comedy. Like, obviously, Get Out had a lot of that, which we'll talk about later. But the level of comedy in Us was so incredibly good. Like, I heard a lot of people saying like, oh, it was too funny and it took me out of it. But to me, everything felt well timed enough that it just felt like it was giving you a minute to breathe before it put you back in this space of what's happening is horrifying. I don't know. I think there was a good balance. I think all of the actors, especially Winston Duke, just really, really killed it in this movie.
Right. Shout out for Winston Duke. Like,
I mean, obviously, like, everyone's talking about Lupita and she should get nominated for an Oscar and she better. But Winston Duke did such, he was so delightful to watch as both roles, absolutely incredible.
My one problem with Us, I mean, and it's not really a problem, it's more of a you know, a caveat, but my only thing is that I felt like it was such a strong film across the board. The little quote-unquote twist they threw at the end, I don't feel like it was necessary.
Oh my god, Holly, I almost felt like because I feel the same way. It was in my notes.
it's true because I thought the whole film was so good, and then they were like, oh well, here's a twist, and I'm like, but you don't have to do that. Like, I almost feel like it's kind of a recent thing in the last 20 years. Maybe it's like the M. Night Shyamalan effect, but people think that you can't have a horror movie without throwing in a twist at the end, and I'm like, you know, sometimes you don't need to. Sometimes you can just tell a great scary horror film and just let it end. But nobody, I don't know, maybe it's a thing of like the film studios who are like, oh no, it can't end here, you have to make a twist. And that was the problem I had with Insidious, which is a great film until the very end, which when they threw in a twist that was totally stupid. But again, with Us, it was so good, and then the end they were like, oh here's a twist, and I was like, oh come on, just don't do it. Just stop. Just stop and end and be scary. You know?
I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. Like, for me, it was that moment where it's like they didn't trust us. They didn't trust us enough to just let it be what it was. And it was like they were kind of explaining something to us. And I would have loved it if it was if it ended the way that the thing ended, where you're just left for years questioning, was one of them the thing? Or was it really them? Like, you'll never know.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have just always been questioning, is she the shadow or is she not the shadow?
But
besides that,
people are too stupid for that.
I definitely see your guys' point. Having the questioning aspect would be really, really cool. I would have liked that ending too. For me, the twist at the end, like, I'm not super attached to it, but I also don't really dislike it. It felt to me like it wasn't so much of a twist for the sake of being a twist, so much as it was maybe, how do I put this? Sort of a twist to make you think about, like, what is the meaning of identity? Sort of like it was a little bit more like a thematic thing than it was like a, oh, look at this, this is crazy, like, kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like the intention of it was a little bit different than that. But it also, I haven't really watched it since it came out. So maybe upon a rewatch, I'll have a different.
But I think with that, like, what you're touching upon also adds to what made it so good is the fact that with his films, there is a message. Like, with this, like, he did an amazing job of having that social commentary of our current political social climate, while also being able to, like, unify the audience and feeling creeped out by what this family is going through. And it's like, and he didn't do it by, like, hammering down this thing into your throat. It's like, he was very craftful by putting this all together in a way that was digestible.
Yeah.
I think that took a lot of skill, and I was very impressed by that.
Yeah. I think that probably the two best directors at that kind of thing right now are probably Jordan Peele and Bong Joon-ho. They're both so good at that.
Yeah. And it's funny. They both have a similar kind of style in that sense. It's like, they take a very serious thing that is very jarring and it gets under your skin, and at the same time they find a way to make it funny where it shouldn't be.
I completely agree.
All right, we are at my picks for best and worst, and for me, this is a film I wish made it onto our list big time. That was Split, because I kind of feel like it came from a writer director M. Night Shyamalan, who's definitely coming out of a slump where people were not liking his films for quite a while. And granted, Avatar: The Last Airbender, which is a film I swore I would never speak about again, you know, definitely brought him into a dark place where we stopped having faith in him. But I think this movie brought him back to greatness. And most of all, it showcased how amazing James McAvoy has always been.
Oh, but God.
I loved McAvoy so much in this movie. Like, it was the kind of performance that for someone who wanted to be an actor, like, it reminded me what made acting so fun and like and so great. Like, he just transforms in a blink of an eye. It kind of disappointed me. Like, I was kind of upset, and I knew it as I watched the movie that he's not going to get nominated for an Oscar. No one's going to recognize how amazing he is right now, and it's going to get glossed over forever.
Sad.
And I just loved it. Like, he transformed his whole body and his personality. It's just something that, till this day, like, it blows my mind just watching his performance. I love watching this film so much. Seeing him turn into Hedwig and then turn into the lady with his freaking little cardigan sweater and everything. He's so prim and proper. And we're on a recorded thing. We only hear our voices, but I'm actually doing the mannerisms as I talk about it. I'm fine.
Well, this is the first film we've been talking about that I actually haven't seen. So
it's
great. But it's been on my list for a long time because I love M. Night Shyamalan. I always will. I have no time for the haters. with a few exceptions of, you know, a few films that kind of miss the mark, but the majority of his films I love. So I've been meaning to watch it for a very long time.
It's great. But I feel that it's for, as a filmmaker, what impresses me about him is not just the fact of how creative he is with his filmmaking, is the fact that he's so passionate about making a film that he puts himself behind, like, this movie he self-funded by making another film before that, which was The Visit. And the way he did both these films, he took out a mortgage on his house twice that he can make these movies. Whoa. And people try to be like, oh, well, no one asked for this, or, you know, he should just stop. It's like, no, he wants to make a film for himself. And if people happen to enjoy it, good for them. And I love that. I love that he's so headstrong to get something done that he's not going to let anything stop him. Like, that's motivating. Mm-hmm. Now, as for the worst movie, not going to sound as nice. This movie got a lot of praise, I felt. Like, it wasn't like a huge blockbuster. This was definitely it was an indie flick. But anyone who watched it and talked about it had nothing but great things to say about it. And that was The Void. The Void... Oh. was written and directed by Jeremy Gillespie and Stephen Kostansky. These two are amazing art directors and makeup artists. They've worked on great films like Pacific Rim, It, Chapter One, actually It Chapter Two, I think too, Scary Stories, Crimson Peak. They're even working on a new Lock and Key series coming out. Like, they generally work on huge films and they do amazing jobs as artists. I don't think that it was a wise decision having them come into a writer-director position because storytelling was not their forte, in my opinion.
Yeah,
this movie really went nowhere. It felt more like a resume to show, like, we can make really cool-looking things. We just don't know the reason to have them be there.
I can't even think of what this movie is. What year did this come out?
It was like 2016?
Yeah, like 2016, yeah.
I enjoyed it. I definitely see where you're coming from, George. Because the most memorable parts of the film were clearly the creatures and the horrifying Lovecraftian designs and all that. And you know, just the general sense of dread. And there wasn't much of a plot, which, you know, I was okay with, but I can see from what you're saying, like, you know, as far as people who are focused on effects and not so much the narrative, how it suffered.
Yeah. Like this could have, and I felt like they were trying to make a modern day From Beyond kind of thing. And granted, From Beyond might not have aged well over the years. I'd rather watch that 100 times over than watch this ever again.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And you know what it is? It's one of those things where, like, it doesn't help where, like, if you're hearing good things about it, and it's like, all right. And you see a trailer for it, and it's like, trailer looks great. This is good. I'm hearing good things from people that I trust. Seeing a cool trailer, let's do this. Mm-hmm. And it was a letdown.
I can't count the number of times that's happened to me. So it's so disappointing. You just hear people gushing and you're just like, oh, this is gonna be the best movie ever, and you put it on, you're like, oh god, why?
But don't take my word for it, watch it yourself.
No, take George's word.
Don't take my word for it. Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Sorry. Take a look, it's in a book, the reading rainbow. Okay, I'm done.
Note to self, make a horror version of Reading Rainbow. Okay.
I'd watch it. I'd star in it, for God's sake. That'd be amazing.
Now I'm going to be thinking about that.
What's on to number on four, we have another kind of favorite of mine, too. I'm so glad it made it on this list. A Quiet Place came out in 2018. Yep.
So directed good.
And starred John Krasinski with Emily Blunt, Millicent Simmons, and Noah Jupe, everyone.
Talk about good creature design.
That's praise, right?
My goodness.
Yeah.
I think they just released, like, today or something, like a teaser for the second one.
Yes, I just watched it today.
How's it look?
It's a teaser. You just get teased. It's just the family walking on sand.
Okay. Talk about good.
That's barely even a teaser. That's just...
Oh my goodness. The Quiet Place had good world building.
Oh, and talk about a movie that, I mean, I don't know if any of you were not fortunate enough to see it in the theater, but talk about a movie that was made for a fucking movie.
Oh yeah. No, we had a meetup for this one too, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we saw it.
Like how ingenious is it?
Yeah.
How ingenious is it to create a film where the slightest bit of noise makes you jump? And so the fact that A Quiet Place is so ingeniously crafted for the theater, where if somebody like giggles or like, you know, whispers to somebody next to them, and you want to like just clock them in the face because, dude, you're in the theater, shut the hell up.
Yeah.
Quiet Place did that just by virtue of being itself. Because nobody wanted to talk. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I've just never gotten over the fact that, like, Jim from The Office movie? That still blows me away. I never would have predicted that. Because I know he's been doing other stuff since, but not like a lot of stuff. And then to come out of nowhere with this, oh my God. Incredible.
And not only as a director as well. Like, wow.
Right.
Director and writer and star. That is impressive stuff.
No, for sure. Well, two things I'll add to that is, first off, John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, power couple of Hollywood.
Hell yes.
Like, I haven't seen like such good on-screen chemistry between like an actual couple since like Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell back in the 80s. Like, you know, and, like, those are two people who are still together today. But I think to add to that, like, a good filmmaker understands that there's more characters on screen besides the actors. And I think that he and the crew understood that sound was a character. Sound was something that had an expression and a feeling that can be shown on screen. That was just, it was, you left you in awe. Like every moment with every character, you understood what sound meant to them, you know? And absolutely. I thought that was huge. And it was really cool. The fact that I think one of the behind the scenes things John was saying is like they learned so much from Millicent Simmons because of what she brought to the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah. You wonder, like, as the experience of clinically deaf person, like what does sound, I mean, obviously, you know, the definition of being deaf is that you don't hear sound, but clearly sound still means something to these people. I think the juxtaposition of that was really, really impressive and powerful. Like the fact that, especially in the opening scene, when they turned around and you know, they could all hear the sound that the plane toy was making. And Millicent Simon's character could not, but she could see their reactions and she could tell what was going on. And that's just such a, I don't know, it's just such a new experience to see in a major blockbuster that I was really impressed by it.
Yeah. I think that's like one of the things about A Quiet Place that was so impressive is that, like, how many times during this movie were you like, that's a new thing that I've never seen before? Because that was pretty much the whole movie for me. It was like, wow, I never would have thought of that. Like, this is so interesting. This is such a cool idea. Like, how did he come up with this? Really incredible.
Yeah.
How about you, Chase? What stuck out for you?
I was just trying to reply.
That goes without saying.
No, I really liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun, and it was really interesting watching a movie that wasn't a silent film where there wasn't much speaking. You know, it was really cool.
Yeah, it made the conversations that they did have that much more impact. Like the one in the base, the only spoken word conversation that they really had was a hell of a thing.
Yeah, it definitely gave their words more weight when it happened.
I just remember them playing Monopoly with felt instead of the metal tokens. Like that's the kind of thing. That's the kind of detail the film did so well. You know, we all grew up playing Monopoly, but you know, we all grew up with those metal tokens. You know, to see it in a totally different context like that was also really cool. So. Mm-hmm. I'm just, yeah. The movie did a lot of that really well.
Body language was important. It was seeing people, their facial expressions and the way they move, like how they communicated with each other, just through that. Aside from like sign language and stuff, it's not something you normally think about. It's like, oh, what if I couldn't speak or hear? Like you'd have to really focus in and pay attention to people. And so that makes you focus on the movie too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. I think that can bring us over to. We're at the top three now. These are some big ones. And I got to say, this is one, number three. I didn't ever think of this one hitting the list at all, despite the fact that it was an amazing film. That was Mad Max Fury Road.
That's why I brought up science fiction, because we were all talking about horror. And I was like, wait a minute. One of the best films of the decade.
It's true.
Post-apocalyptic science fiction film.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 2015 was a good year. You know, George Miller came back, wrote and directed. We had starring Tom Hardy, Charlize Theron, Nicholas Hoult, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley. This, I know for me personally, this was a great example of like how you can have CGI with practical effects, and it was all seamless. You couldn't even tell. You thought every scene was on location at like that kind of spot, and to find out later on, it's like, no, that's what it didn't look like that.
Fury Road just absolutely blew me away. It just, in so many ways, because the whole thing is a non-stop road movie. Like it's even more so than Road Warrior, which is like its namesake. It just goes and goes and goes and goes, and then you have this really existential, like, you know, middle part, and then it reverses, and then again it just goes and goes and goes and goes, and it's the movie is like, it's like the definition of the journey is the story, you know. I was just so many parts, like the when I was first watching it, when they're going through they're going in to the sandstorm, the desert storm, and it's like this massive cloud mass and coming to this giant caravan of like trucks and cars, and I just remember looking at that and being like, what is this film? Like, this is incredible. I've never seen this. Wow. Capital W-O-W for me.
It's rare to get a movie with such a large cast as this, where it really, like, even if it doesn't go into everybody as much, each character feels like a whole fleshed out person and doesn't feel like a throwaway. Like, you can tell they really cared about all of their characters. And for a movie like For a Quiet Place, there's four people in that movie pretty much. So it's easy to really see them as a person and really kind of like get into the meat of who they are and care about them. And obviously no one in a movie like that feels like a throwaway, but like there were so many people in Fury Road, and all of them had something about them that made them important. Even the wives who weren't able to fight as hard as like Furiosa were like reloading and turning themselves into shields and stuff like that. It's like no one was not a part of it, which I thought was really something special.
Yeah, and also, and as you said, the wives who in any, you know, in any other action sci-fi film would be relegated to basically just being dead
victims.
Weight.
Yeah.
Were able to harness the power that they had and basically show themselves off to Immortan Joe or whatever. Whereas in any other action apocalyptic sci-fi film, the characters like that would just be relegated to just dead weight and like just people to save, regardless of who they were. And I just thought so impressive.
Yeah, I gotta say, like, that was something that definitely stuck out to me in this movie. Like, I kind of actually felt like this was called Mad Max Fury Road, but it wasn't a Mad Max film. This was a film set in a Mad Max world. Because for me, this was Furiosa's story, and all the wives, you know, and in this world, we got to see, like, it's post-apocalyptic. In that kind of setting, everyone has to survive. There's no one could be a weak link, and they showed that the people who you thought would have been weak were strong, and they all had their moment. They all had something to give, and I agree. Like that was something that was very powerful and moving for this film. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like I was at a place at the end, I wanted a Furiosa film. Like I want a part two and a part three that continues on with this story. And to add to that, it's like I was so happy their relationship between Max and her was not a love story. I was so happy to see that it was two warriors that were like brethren in this battle, you know, and they had honor and respect for one another. That was such a good ending.
Sex would have been such a lowest common denominator bullshit thing. Like I was, I can't even describe how happy I was that that was not their relationship. And also, you're right, George. I mean, it despite being called a Mad Max film, Mad Max was the secondary character here.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kudos to Tom Hardy for being amazing and for deferring to the rest of the film.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
He makes it great, like a great feral man. Mm-hmm.
Which I will say that if there was one bad thing that I had to say about the film, it would be the fact that his Mad Max, like that Max did not necessarily feel like it went with the rest of the series. Mm-hmm. Like it did feel like it went just a step back because with the other ones, you did feel like Max was growing. And this was like, well, I guess he hasn't grown that much.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it has been a really long time.
But granted. That's nitpicking at that point. That's just amazing. Speaking of picks, Holly, what was your favorite film that didn't make it to this list? And
wow. Okay. So I had a hard time trying to figure out which movie to pick as my best of the decade between Dave Betamaze and Rigor Mortis. I ultimately went with Rigor Mortis because I feel like foreign films don't get enough love in general on best of lists and in awards in general. Rigor Mortis is a Chinese vampire film. It was from 2013, directed by first time director Juno Mok, who was he's an actor and producer before, but this is literally his first feature, which I can't, like, what? I hate you. Like, wow. just to introduce it, like, what I love about Asian vampire mythology is that it's so different. You know how, you know, the general, like, Eastern European Dracula mythology is that vampires are these autonomous aristocrats living in castles that are in complete charge of their existence, and they run their lives as well as they can, and the regular lay people have no idea they exist. That's basically the Western ideal. There's a huge difference in Eastern Asian vampire mythology, in which vampires are created from corpses or from nearly dead people by their loved ones who want to resurrect them because they're not ready to let go of them. And in that sense, it makes the vampire character more of a victim than any kind of monster. That's the difference between the two, the Eastern and Western vampire mythologies, that really impresses me. And Rigor Mortis, likewise, is about a movie actor who moves into a very, very strange apartment complex. But while in this apartment complex, a couple, an old lady, her husband, is killed. And through the help of a shaman, she resurrects him to be a vampire. And there are so many elements to this film that would be end game in any other horror film. Like, there's a pair of twin ghosts living in an apartment where, you know, in any other horror movie, you'd be like, oh, the twin ghost, like, that's the thing. That's what's going to be the end. But no, in this film, it's all a combination of things. And there's a vampire hunter who has to, you know, the very end has to compete, like, you know, because in Chinese mythology, there are five elements, including metal, and he has to defeat the vampire in every single one of those elements. And it's so hard to describe, but the most spectacular final 20 minutes of a horror action film I think I've ever seen. It's Ooh. Just incredible. Like if you have not seen Rigor Mortis, written or directed by Juno Mok, it's everything you could ever want from a horror fantasy film. In my opinion, it's brutal and gross at times and kind of disturbing. And but the payoff is absolutely there. So yeah, I just wanted to highlight that one because like I said, foreign films don't get a lot of love on year-end lists or decade-end lists as we're doing now. It's absolutely a must-see. If you have not seen it, get on that shit.
So with the vampires, like when they get brought back, are they aware of what happened, or are they sort of like mindless beasts?
No, they're essentially mindless beasts. There's an interesting twist in this one that I don't want to give away, where they harness the power of a different dead entity to basically empower the vampire. But yeah, to me that it's just such a different idea. But you know, between the Dracula of the Western vampire world and these sort of helpless corpses in the Eastern world that are they're just sort of animated by their loved ones who refuse to give them up. You know, like it's so fascinating to me. So yeah, rigor mortis, watch it, people. We're gonna go in a different direction, and I'm gonna talk about a movie that everyone said was the best thing they'd ever seen, and Sorry, what?
I know what you're gonna say.
Yeah, no, I know, because you loved it.
Well, because I'm it was, right.
No, you just sit there in your wrongness.
anyway, go.
Honestly, a lot of it was because that everyone gushed so much about it and said it was like the best horror movie since God knows when. And so when I sat down to watch it, I was expecting that. And I did not get what I wanted. And the movie is Hereditary. I admit to yelling at the screen in the middle of the film in just abject like annoyance, just yelling at the main character, the main wife character, just shut up, nobody cares, at the top of my lungs. Because one of my biggest pet peeves in horror films is the hysterical wife meme, which is essentially you know, in a family or wherever, or somebody's experiencing ghosts or something, you know, it's the wife, or usually the wife of a family is the one who goes crazy and decides to be like, oh, this is nuts and this is weird and now I can't handle it and I'm turning into a psychopath, and the rest of her family is like, okay, we'll just take this in stride, and of course the husband is always the down to earth one. And he's like, oh, you're going crazy. And the wife is like, I'm not crazy. I'm just empathetic. And yeah, it's a trope that really bugs me. And that's probably a big part of the reason that I hated Hereditary so much. Because it was the embodiment of that trope.
But the whole point was that she wasn't actually right about anything. She was going about everything the wrong way. And, like, she might have been correct in that there might have been some supernatural stuff going on. I've seen a few different sort of interpretations of was any of this really real or any of that. But, like, the tropes were, like, the point, though.
But I can't, no. I mean, like,
no.
Why is a trope the point? No. I love Toni Collette. Don't get me wrong. I love Toni Collette. She is one of my favorite actresses of all time. She's in so many of my favorite movies. And that's another reason I was really looking forward to it. And she did a great job with what she was given. But I felt like what she was given was so cheap and just... When I reviewed it, I gave it 1.5 stars.
I remember that.
The half star literally came from... should I give a spoiler here? Do people care?
We've all watched this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the half star literally came from the part where the daughter gets her head cut off. Because.
Oh, wow.
Because I was not expecting it. It was shocking. It was original. And I was like, wow, okay. That I did not expect that to happen.
I know.
I'm impressed.
Ari Aster is going to give you head trauma in his films every single time, is what it seems like.
Great. Awesome.
There's a lot of head trauma in Midsummer. I don't know yet.
Hammer time.
But that was the only part of Hereditary. That was the only part of Hereditary to me that made me go, wow. So I gave it an extra half star for that. After that, meh, especially the ending. My God. Oh, I think I looked over to my roommate and went, that was fucking stupid. So anyway, I'll stop. But Hereditary, I thought, was absolutely the worst terrible thing of the decade. Moving on.
Well, I think that leads up perfectly, because the title of this second film here probably leads right into what Jason is thinking in his head, which is Get Out.
Only a little bit.
This came out in 2017, also written and directed by Jordan Peele, starring Daniel Kaluuya, Allison Williams, Catherine Keener, and Bradley Whitford. This is the movie that made every comedic actor think, hey, I can do that. But no one has been able to replicate the lightning in a bottle that Get Out has, except for Peele himself with Us. How was everyone else's take on this?
I was just thinking about this last night, but has there ever been a director that releases one film and everyone is like, he's a maestro? You know what I mean? Because I feel like everyone leading up to Get Out, the trailers were all very misleading, which I felt like kind of added to the experience. It really didn't let you know what was going on with this at all. Just that there was something really weird happening. Because all anyone knew of Jordan Peele was from Key and Peele, and like the kind of like one, like they were in like a few episodes of Fargo and stuff like that. But I don't think anyone was expecting this. And then when it happened, everyone was like, new master of horror. It's him. Can't be anyone but him. He is the new master of horror. I mean, it landed.
You're right. It was very dramatic.
It was so sudden and yet so deserved, because this really was like, who saw this coming?
I mean, the thing that I appreciated the most about Get Out, and don't get me wrong, when I loved it. I wouldn't call it my best of the decade, but I thought it was great. But what I appreciated the most about it was that I can honestly say I had never seen anything like it from beginning to end. Like not beyond just the creepy old racist family, because there are films about young people going back to visit old families that have horrible secrets.
Yeah.
But the general conceit of it, what the dad did, you know, the brain surgery and the hypnotism and the
bingo game itself.
The bingo game.
Yeah.
All of it. It was I really admire something when I can go on and watch it and be like, wow, this reminds me of nothing, because this has never been done before. And that's what I got from Get Out, which it was amazing. I was really impressed.
Chickadee Chase, how about you, buddy?
Sorry.
I liked it. Ooh. I thought it was really interesting and fun and creepy. I didn't think it was like, to me, it wasn't like an amazing horror film. I don't know. It was like, I don't know, like a Skeleton Key.
Mm.
Have you guys seen that one?
Okay. Yeah.
I have not seen Skeleton
Key,
so.
Very long time, but yeah.
Yeah. They essentially used voodoo to move their body, like to move them from like body to body kind of thing. Kind of like how in this, they're using like the surgery and everything to move it from body to body. And there's the whole like racist aspect to it in both films, and it's just,
it's actually a very good point. Yeah, I totally forgot about that. Yeah, it's just the roles are reversed. Instead of it being a white power taking over the black people, it's black people taking over the white people in Skeleton Key. Yeah,
I mean,
really, because I've never seen Skeleton Key. Is that actually what it's about?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah, it's worth watching.
I liked Skeleton Key.
Who was the actress that was Skeleton Key?
Kate Hudson.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Blanked on her name.
Yeah. So like, I thought it was a good movie and everything. It was. That's my thing with like horror movies. I always wanted to be like, how scary can it be? How terrifying can it be? And, like, I understand like, there's more aspects to films. There's this angle, that angle. Like, what's the message you're trying to put out? What's all kinds of stuff. But I just want to be scared shitless when I watch a horror film. And it was like a really good story, and it was had some good creepy parts to it, but it didn't have that lingering, like keeps me up at night kind of fear. That's the only reason I'd be like, it's not my favorite
I understand
horror
that.
film, but it was definitely one of my favorite films of that year.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Chase. Actually, I was really impressed with it. I thought it was great, but I wouldn't call it like it didn't haunt my dreams, so to speak. But I'm also not black.
I'm kind of the opposite. Like, I'm never going into a movie expecting to be scared, and it's funny because every time I see a horror movie, which is fairly frequently, my mom is like, "Was it really scary?" And I'm like, "No, because it was a movie." And I don't know, there's like unsettling, but I don't know. I'm kind of the opposite end where I'm looking at the other parts of it than just the frightening parts. But the idea of the sunken place, that's pretty unsettling.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the creepy parts. It's kind of like it's kind of Lovecraftian, you know? It's kind of like a void, unknown, like you're trapped.
Absolutely. I had the same thought.
Yeah, I gotta say, I did love this movie. I thought it was a great movie. Anyone who has spoken with me about this film knows how I truly feel though of its genre. Because I'm kind of with you in that sense, Chase, of like, is it not scary to an extent? But like, I argue that it's not a horror film, that it's actually a suspense thriller film, which you can still be afraid of things in that kind of sense, but just not in the horror sense, you know? But at the end of the day, that doesn't change the fact of it gets under your skin, and no pun intended there, considering what they do. But like the raw emotion like that Daniel Kaluuya exudes in this film was breathtaking.
He's such a great actor.
I honestly felt like he was so good in this that he was underutilized in Black Panther. They had such a top-notch actor that just got pushed to the side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, but they also had
I'm not knocking anyone else in that film. That film was filled with amazing actors.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I just felt
including Winston Duke,
and who shined. He was great in that film, but I just felt someone else who was also amazing. I didn't get to see the amazingness that we know he can bring to the screen.
Yeah,
you know, and this film showcased that. This was a breakout role for a lot of people. You know,
You know, George, I completely agree with you on it being a suspense thriller because I have this bizarre criteria where. It doesn't feel like a horror film to me unless there's something distinctly supernatural or off or like not reality about it. And it's like, Get Out is terrifying and horrible and people are terrible and white people are fucking terrifying and all that stuff. But at the same time, technically all of, except maybe the hypnotism, but technically all of it could happen in the real world. So I can see where you're coming from as far as it being a suspense thriller because I tend to agree that movies without a supernatural element don't feel horrific to me, but that might just be my own.
No, and that could be part of how I felt when I watched it. Honestly, I'm with you on that kind of stuff. I'd say after watching this though, I totally understood why they let Jordan Peele like take the reins to the Twilight Zone, because when you see this movie feels like it could have been an episode in the Twilight Zone, you know. I can imagine, like, if they did a re-edit of this thing, and it opens up with just, like, the voice is like, imagine, if you will, a family, a town of near perfection. But Chris Washington is going to find out, is perfection beyond skin deep? Only here, in the Twilight Zone.
That was really good.
Encore! That was amazing. Absolutely true. I agree. I think that's probably, Get Out was... It did strike me as a very, very long Twilight Zone episode, which is a compliment because the Twilight Zone is the best television show of all time. So, you know.
In which he has done a phenomenal job with. I have loved his take on it. All right, man, we're at the end. This is it. This is the one.
Top movie of the decade.
And I'm so proud and happy to say that it is The Shape of Water.
Hell yeah.
2017 was a wonderful fucking year.
Guillermo, we love you.
It's like, and we're not being biased here because he's a fellow monster kid or anything like that. It's like, he just knocked it out of the park.
It's true.
Him and the cast, Sally Hawkins, Michael Shannon, Richard Jenkins comes back, Octavia Spencer.
Michael Shannon can do anything he wants. I would watch Michael Shannon. I would watch him just talking to a fucking wall. Like, he's so good. I love him.
Importantly,
Okay, those are my feelings on Michael Shannon. Sorry.
Doug Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my Doug God. Jones, the unsung hero of a good few of Guillermo's films. This man, he needs awards.
That's the thing is that he's not unsung anymore.
It took now, though. That's the thing. He's been doing... he's been doing such phenomenal work for years, and it has been unnoticed, you know, because he's been the guy behind the mask. He's our modern so day, you know, Boris Karloff, and no one realizes it.
Well, there's a reason that he's Lon Chaney. There's a reason that when we put him on the cover of the 289, I called him the new man of a thousand faces because he is. And I remember interviewing him for that issue because we were interviewing him. I mean, I was interviewing him mostly for the stuff that he had done, but this was early 2017 and Shape of Water had not come out yet. And we were talking about all of his other roles, like, you know, the Abe Sapien stuff and all the other Guillermo stuff and just everything that he'd done and the way he talked about the this is gonna win all the awards. Such a cool guy, though. By the way, Doug Jones, man, kudos to you, man. You are so cool. You're just down to earth and just also a lot older than a lot of people think. He's been doing this for a really long time.
I guess it's to add to how nice he is. I remember my first year with Famous Monsters was at Comic-Con 2015. And within that,
youngin.
I just turned 36, but yeah, I feel young still.
Sorry.
We were at that show, and I'm walking the one of the aisles, and sitting down on the floor against the wall, taking a rest, was Doug Jones.
And I just
had this moment. Like I'm pretty good about if I see an actor or someone of fame, I kind of just let them be and whatever, and I know if it was me, I don't want someone making a big hubbub of who I am. But I was kind of just surprised. Like, I was like, Doug Jones? And he's like, hey, how's it going? And I was like, I'm just surprised you're just sitting down there out of nowhere. He's like, oh, I'm just resting. Like, and I got to sit down with him, chat, and he let me take a picture with him. And it was just so cool that I could just, he could be himself and I could be myself. And it wasn't like this weird, like, oh my God, you're a star, you know? And like, it wasn't a geeked out moment and it wasn't something that was too overblown. And it was so amazing. Well,
do you think it's partially because so many of his roles are behind heavy makeup, like that maybe he feels like he doesn't have to be that with other random people because people barely recognize. I mean, I'm sure people recognize him now because everyone knows who he is. Yeah,
I was thinking like that pre Shape of Water. It's like if you were, you know, into the industry, you knew who he was, but then like now that he's, I mean, he's on the new Star Trek too. So it's like,
as a major character,
right. With Shape of Water and Discovery, I feel like that's what really thrust him into the public eye with his face. Because, I mean, everyone has seen Pan's Labyrinth and knows Pale Man and the Fawn. But most people didn't know that they were both played by him or what he looked like. I think that was a big part of it. Going back to Shape of Water itself, one of the things that I really loved about it was the whole setting, how it felt very fleshed out, and yet they barely kind of touched on it. It was just, this is how this world is. We're moving on because we have other stuff to talk about. But it still felt very complex, well-established world that felt very like 1950s without being completely grounded in reality, which really drove the fairy tale aspect of it home in a very good way.
Well, and also, I mean, not to, you know, sound like a social unicorn or anything, but part of what was amazing about this film was the major cast is just, you have a mute girl falling in love with a freaking fish man. The mute girl's best friends are a sassy black woman played by Octavia Spencer, who just kills it, and a senior gay man played by Richard Jenkins, who also kills it. Just to have that like sort of quadruple whammy of weird, like not weirdness, I shouldn't say that, but the quadruple whammy of not normalness facing what are basically a bunch of really obnoxious white men mm-hmm. just made me just love it even more.
Yeah, there was a lot of added poignancy to it because of that. I felt like the fact that,
no offense to present white men, Chase,
but the fact that she was
you don't count. Yeah,
the fact that she was only really able to talk about her feelings, the depth of her feelings, that amazing, it's weird to call it a speech because it was done entirely in sign language, but when she was saying to him, like, basically, like, he doesn't see me for my flaws, that really, really emotional mm-hmm. moment, the fact that she was explaining yeah. all of this to a man that is gay, that is clearly suffering in this setting for it, it just yeah. added so much poignancy and depth. It really blew me away.
Agreed.
And yeah. also the design of Fishman was incredible.
Emotional. Right? Because they made him clearly an homage mm-hmm. to the creature from the Black Lagoon, but not right. looking like him at all. Like he yeah. was totally yeah. his own Fishman. Is in a weird way. He was his own Fishman. There's this Fishman. There's the typical Fishman, yeah. but he was his own Fishman. Wow. What kind of world are we in where like Fishman is like a
good one.
A cliche. There's a cliche Fishman, and then there's a different Fishman.
No, but wow, he was beautiful. He really, all the color designs.
Even when he ate the cat.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
even
he ate the cat. Yeah, I think that what made that yeah. so good, like, compared to other stories, there's other films and other TV shows that try to make a point when it comes to the social injustices that we go through today, whether it's through race or sex and everything. And when you put it as your forefront, it can feel like this thing that you're being lectured about. Mm-hmm. And then the message that you're trying mm-hmm. to get across and have a good point behind gets lost, because then you're just like, all right, I understand. I get it. I'm going through struggles too, but you don't have to tell me. This movie wasn't doing that. This movie mm-hmm. focused on Agreed. The characters.
Yeah.
The characters that just happened to have
yep.
these things that they were dealing with. They weren't who they were necessarily. And even when it was brought to the forefront, yep. it showed how they overcame those things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what matters. Like it's there's so much more to you than that one thing. I think that's what made it so fun and relatable for all of us in each of our own ways.
Plus, I absolutely, George, that was amazing and deep and awesome. But also, can we just celebrate the fact this is basically Creature from the Black Lagoon fan fiction?
Oh, yeah.
That's literally what it is. It's like somebody being like, ooh, the creature from the Black Lagoon is sexy. I want to write a cool, sexy story where he gets to have sex with a random...
That's
custodian.
What Guillermo del Toro said in an interview. Like, I mean, he didn't go straight for the sex, but he was like, the moment in Creature from the Black Lagoon where he's swimming beneath the woman in the water, it just looked like love to me. That was like one of the first times I saw like love on screen.
And that's so empowering. I mean, if Guillermo can go and make a movie that's essentially Creature from the Black Lagoon fan fiction and win a million Oscars for it, there is hope for all of us. Like, wow.
It's not fan yeah. fiction, it's fin fiction.
Boom.
Oh, touche, Chase. Good one. The
exotic puns that Sorry. Chase and I say to each other.
Oh my God.
With their
fin fiction.
Gotta keep Fori alive like that.
Good job, Chase, making us proud.
It's true. Yeah, no, A's are yeah. A-plus on that one, Chase.
So. What was a standout moment for you, Chase?
Honestly, like, one of the best parts of it, I think, is just the very beginning when you just hear like the voiceover talking about her, and like the mm-hmm. room is filled with water and everything's kind of like coming down, and then it's like she begins her night and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Something about that mm-hmm. opening, I just like, I don't know. I just love that opening. And it's just the whole movie, everything. Like, I can't think of any parts of it that I didn't like. Yeah.
It
yeah.
is a fairy tale. I think that's part of what makes the opening so powerful is fairy tales always start with mm-hmm. narration, yeah. you know, out loud narration. Yeah. It's like, this is what happened. the fact that that's what Shape of Water did in the very beginning mm-hmm. makes it a fairy tale.
Yeah, in a way that it's almost kind of interesting that this is the one on the top of our list, because like you guys were kind of saying with Get Out, like it doesn't feel like a horror movie. Like it, there's parts of it that do, because it's like he's a sea monster. He is the creature from the Black Lagoon, mm-hmm. pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It did not feel like a horror movie to me. It just felt like a fairy tale.
Yeah.
It was a love story more than anything.
Even though it's technically a monster movie, because it's about a monster and falling in love with a monster and the different ways that people manifest as monsters. Yeah. Because can we go back to Michael Shannon? Yeah. Holy shit.
I've never felt so awkward.
I know. I was like, no.
It's like, oh, don't say that.
Yeah, I just, yeah. Oh, no, there, sorry. That was not what it sounded like.
No, you're good.
Every time I go to the bathroom at a public place, I always think of... I always think of him talking about washing his hands.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh God. Oh, I know, right? Oh, the real men don't. Oh, man.
That guy washes hands before or after. I'm gonna use a paper towel to open the door.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in the real world, I guess there's a lot of real men out there.
But also the gangrene, like the finger gangrene, is just such a great metaphor for everything that he was doing and going through. Like that whole horrible saga that begins at the beginning, where he gets his fingers bitten off, and then they try to reattach them, and they just rot and they just fall off, and it's
when he rips those off. Jeez.
It's so awesomely gross.
Well, everyone who's listening, that was our top 10 films for the past, 10 years or so. The 2010s were pretty crazy. They started off slow, but they ended phenomenally.
Yeah.
If you guys want to see what our favorite shows, comic books, and games were, though, over the past 10 years, make sure to check out our Best Of article, which will be on famousmonsters.com. I will leave a link in the description. Woo-hoo! You don't want to miss that. Chase. Mm-hmm. Where can people follow us?
They can follow us on Facebook. You search for @FMOFL, Famous Monsters of Filmland. Go to Instagram, just search Famous Monsters, or go to Twitter, Famous Monsters. Boom.
Also Tumblr, Famous Monsters, for the record. Not that
for all
anybody
you Tumblr folk out there that are tumbling around.
Tumblr, unless they're writing fan fiction. Hey, we talked about fan fiction earlier. Fan fiction writers.
For all you Famous Monsters loving Tumblers out there, tumble on down and check it out.
And don't forget to check out our Famous Monsters channel on YouTube. See any of our archived episodes or even old podcasts on there. We'll be seeing you in the ghoul year. Stay spooky, my friends.
Oh, yes.